listeners will find your input very helpful. And until next time, I'm Mike Smith.
How can the Homeschool Legal Defense Association help you? Well, to find out, contact us and ask for a free copy of You Can Homeschool. Visit our website at homeschoolheartbeat.com. That's homeschoolheartbeat.com.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta. Join me and my guests as we try to develop conversations of consequence. It's talk radio where God matters, looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO. Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO. Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the Internet at WDEO.net.
My guest today is John Beaumont. John is with us from Leeds in England, from West Yorkshire. He's a lawyer, and he's formerly head of the School of Law at Leeds Metropolitan. But after working in the courts and several other universities, he moved on to become a legal consultant and a freelance writer on Catholic issues. And he's written at least two books that came to my attention on converts. The first of these was entitled Roads to Rome, A Guide to Notable Converts from Britain and Ireland from the Reformation to the Present Day. That came out in 2010 from St. Augustine's Press. And then recently in 2014, he published a book entitled The Mississippi Flows into the Tiber, A Guide to Notable American Converts to the Catholic Church. It is available from Fidelity Press, and you can go to fidelity.org to look at it, as I have done. John, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you very much, Dale. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you from England, in fact.
Yes, well, we can tell from your accent where you're from. John, you know, these books are long. They're comprehensive, wonderful books to have.
Thank you.
Because the issue of converts, the theme of conversion, is one that's perennially interesting to many, many Catholics. What got you into writing at this length about converts?
Right. Well, I think a particular contact, which was a very important one to me, which was a contact with Father Stanley Yockey.
Oh, I knew Father Yockey very well.
Right, the very eminent, very famous priest physicist, Benedictine, who died in 2009. I was very interested, although I was a lawyer, I was interested in science, and I was so interested in Father Yockey's books and had difficulty in getting some of them over here, so I was rather cheeky and sent him a letter, and he immediately responded, and I worked with him, basically helping him on some of his research for about 5 years. And I suppose, in a sense, it was he who got me started. He thought that the church in the last 20 or 30 years was rather downplaying converts and conversion. And he was worried about this. He also saw signs of a sort of subjectivism and relativism in the church or in certain theologians, and he saw that conversion was, as he thought, an objective process, so this concerned him. He, as with myself, I think, have come across a number of people, sometimes even priests, who have said, say, to Methodists or Presbyterians or over in your country, Episcopalians, well, stay a good Methodist. Don't bother converting to the Catholic Church. And this worried him intensely. I think it worried him even more because he'd written by this time several books on Newman. And, of course, saw that Newman was keen on the whole notion of the one true church and the need to convert to it. So he started to encourage me to compile lists of converts to prove that they were still around and that people were still still saw the church as the one true church and wanted to join it.
Let's just start with the numbers. I mean, how many converts do you list in your book on English converts and how many on American?
Well, I would think approximately the same, round about just under 500, I would have thought, between 450 and 500. But, of course, they're, I use the word notable, they're notable converts. I don't want to give the wrong impression there because you might think that notable converts are the famous people or the great intellectuals. Of course, all converts are equally valuable to God. And many converts who are basically unknown to us, I'm sure, lead better lives than ones who are well known to us. Essentially, that's about the numbers. Of course, the entries are differential in the sense that as I proceeded, the process rather changed. At first, and I think under Father Yaki's encouragement, it was simply a matter of putting down names and saying a little bit about these people. But I think as I became aware of the amount of what I'd call attacks on the Catholic Church, both from outside, from, you've heard no doubt about the new atheists. I think you have some, don't you? Daniel Dennett would be one of them.
Yeah, but I think you guys are leading the charge on that.
Yeah. Well, we have the dreaded, I nearly said dreadful, Richard Dawkins, and of course Stephen Hawking as well. I saw that, and I saw some attacks, frankly, from inside the church, sort of fifth columns, as it were. And then I saw that along came Benedict XVI, and there seemed to be a change towards an emphasis, at least on his part, away from subjectivism towards more of an objective approach. And so, really, that brought into my mind the importance of not just listing converts and their lives, but really giving some account of the reasons they gave for their conversion. In a sense, the book has become more a book on apologetics than a simple history of people's lives. Particularly important, I think, because many converts obviously thought out the thing in very detailed terms and gave comprehensive reasons. Many of the accounts were out of print. And, of course, I think not only Catholics but non-Catholics as well are fascinated by personal biographies, personal accounts of these individuals, particularly the difficulties that they overcome on their way. And, of course, one shouldn't just think it's a matter of logical reason. It isn't, of course. It's a matter of grace and of essential faith.
Well, in your book, John, in your book about English converts, did you happen to treat Alec Guinness, the famous actor?
I did indeed, yes.
I thought his book on his conversion was just marvelous.
Yes, and of course he wrote some delightful accounts, which I think were gleaned from his diaries. And he was a rather lovable character, I think.
Oh, yes, and he could write like an angel.
Indeed so. And of course, since he's died, Piers Paul Reid has written a very good biography of Guinness, which brings out, you know, some of the difficulties he had in his life, in his own personal life, but really does emphasize the strength of his thoughts when he converted. He didn't, by the way, like the liturgical changes.
In fact, I think most converts go into the church and are rather surprised at the shape of the liturgy once they get there.
Yes, I think that's particularly today. I think less so in the past. I think Evelyn Waugh, for example, was highly satisfied with the liturgy of the church when he converted, and that continued to be the case. And he loved to go to Downside to the Holy Week ceremonies, but unfortunately they were then changed. I mean, he died before the new rite of mass came in, but he died in 1966 in that sort of transition.
Too bad we didn't have him around to satirize the new liturgical.
Well, yes, he would have done a wonderful job, wouldn't he? Yeah, books like Black Mischief and Scoop turned into the the 70s and the 80s, when there was a lot of sort of pretentious ideas floating about, would have been a wonderful antidote, I think, but we didn't have them. We didn't have an equivalent writer, unfortunately. Great shame.
I noticed that in your book about American converts, with the title The Mississippi Flows into the Tiber, that you pick up on the conversion of one of my favorite people, the great golfer Bobby Jones.
I did indeed.
A lot of people don't know that. I often mention that he converted a few days before his death, and it comes as news to them.
Under the influence of his wife, this had gone on for some considerable time. Yeah, you're probably talking to the right person here, because I was a serious golfer at one time and less serious now. But Bobby Jones in your country, and then Henry Cotton. The English, fine English player.
One of the greatest putters of all time?
Yeah, they were, I think. Yeah. Number of sporting figures I came across when I was doing the...
Only golfers?
No, not particularly golfers. George Gipp, you may know of. Knut Rockne.
You mean, did he convert while he was at Fordham or after?
I'm not sure what the answer is to that question. I'm tempted to say, have a look in the book.
Right, I will.
And then, of course, Floyd Patterson, the boxer.
Now, when did that take place? Because I was a young boy when Floyd Patterson.
Sure. Well, I think we're around about the same generation, and I think it was during he had literally a misspent youth. I think various convictions. And then I think he was prevailed upon in what would be the equivalent of some sort of approved school or Borstal, and eventually came to the church. And I think this was before, it was probably during his amateur boxing career, you know, that sort of area, which I think there was an emphasis there, wasn't there, on moral training and reparation for difficulties in one's younger life. I think that's probably when he came to the faith.
I'm talking to John Beaumont from Leeds, England, about two books that he's published, one this year entitled The Mississippi Flows into the Tiber, A Guide to Notable American Converts to the Catholic Church, and a earlier book about English converts. Now, John, I wanted to ask, I know this is a kind of a ridiculous question given that you list nearly 1,000 converts, but are there any constant themes that return over and over again as you read the stories of these converts?
You mean basically...
What attracted them?
The reasons why were. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. I mean, I'd start by saying that, frankly, they're all shapes and sizes. I think Chesterton said that the Catholic Church was a house with 100 gates, and that no two people enter at exactly the same angle. And I think, as with many of these things, there's a profound truth in that. Traditionally, one sees, I suppose, the three usual steps, belief in the existence of God, the divinity of Christ, and then, of course, the crucial issue for Catholics, the nature of the Church. As far as Christ and Christ's divinity is concerned, I think, particularly in America, I saw two themes, two important themes. One, they might be called the historical and the philosophical theme. The historical theme was a realization of the essential historicity of the Gospels. In other words, that if the Gospels were a pack of lies, then Christianity must be the most brilliant hoax of all time. And so how could a few unlettered Jews invent Christ and then make the story tally with Old Testament prophecy? And how could these four simple evangelists make up the most memorable, influential, and lovable character in history? Impossible. Many converts came to believe. And in contradistinction from Christ, Muhammad therefore seems a ghost, really. That was the historical side. The philosophical side, and as I say, I found this very predominant in America, and I have some thoughts as to why this is the case. It's the old bad, mad, or God argument.
Say that one more time. Repeat that again.
Yeah, this is what's sometimes called the bad, mad, or God argument. In other words, there's a claim, isn't there? A claim to be God, in the sense of our Lord forgiving sins, saying that he always existed, proposing to judge the world. There's a claim there, a tremendous claim, really. And the argument says, well, anybody who makes this claim can't just be a good human being. Either because the claim is so, in a sense, almost preposterous. Either the claim is true, or this is the world's greatest imposter. And that argument was put forward, well, you can see glimpses of it in the New Testament, but and this is where America comes in.
Yeah.
I think it was put forward most notably in modern literature by two people. One is Chesterton, and the other is C.S. Lewis. And Chesterton has been until...
But Lewis wasn't a convert, right?
Well, this is the strange thing. I mean, if I ask myself, who do these converts put forward as influencing them? Individuals. What sort of names come up? Well, Aquinas, Newman, Chesterton. I'm talking now specifically about the American book.
Yes.
And C.S. Lewis. Now, C.S. Lewis stands out, as you rightly say. He was not a Catholic. He never became a Catholic, although... Some wag once said, well, he was a sort of cryptic Jesuit, but certainly not, and not these days, I'm afraid.
But he was an Irishman.
He was, and that, I think, explains a lot. It's his early life in Northern Ireland in extreme Protestantism, really. And you can see it, I think, even in his more mature life. He did have a tendency to talk about papists, and there wasn't...
A Catholic would never write a book called Mere Christianity.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And this is where it becomes weak, doesn't it? He's superb on the existence of God in that book and on that particular argument for Christ and the divinity of Christ. But when he comes to the church, it's, well, you know, there are plenty of rooms in this mansion and just go in the one that's most comfortable to you. Which I feel is something, well, certainly something of a cop-out. But it is remarkable that somebody who never became a Catholic has had such a massive influence on people becoming Catholics. Not just becoming Christians, he's done that, but becoming Catholics. And there are many people in the book who put Lewis down as a key influence, not just, as I say, to their becoming Christians, but to them actually becoming Catholics.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Lewis never became Catholic, but he studied medieval and Renaissance literature, so he was in the middle of a Catholic world, Catholic culture, and Catholic philosophical and theological frame of mind. I mean, he soaked it up.
He was. I can only put... Christopher Derrick wrote a book on this, and Joe Pierce has written one as well, and I think they both agree that it's this sort of almost aboriginal prejudice that he had that stemmed from his early life, and it never really quite left him for whatever reason, I don't know. And so he didn't finally convert in the sense that we would conceive of it. Now, he has been, in a sense, somewhat ignored in my country until recent years, as has Chesterton particularly, whereas... People like Dale Alquist have taken up the Chesterton cause in your country and done massive things, I think, in relation to that. So that's probably why there's this particular influence in America.
Well, let me ask you this question. I'm talking with John Beaumont about his two books on converts. First, his book on converts in England, and then his book on converts in America. How much does the theme of the problem of modernity come up in your research?
That's a good one. Right.
You could call it modernity and its discontents.
And its discontents, right. It's there. It's there in... I feel that many... I was going to move on to the church itself, you know, the reasons for entering the church as opposed to coming to a belief in the divinity of Christ. And I think it's there that people, I think, are affected by, very often, by the older writers, you know, by people like Ronald Knox, by Chesterton, by Belloc, by Evelyn Waugh, and of course by Newman. And so they are not, in my experience, looking so much at modern writers. I'm talking about those who write about their conversion. Maybe they are...
No, I'm thinking more about not who they're reading, but what they're reacting against. You know, with modernity, you have the onslaught of Darwinism, existentialism, psychoanalysis.
Yes.
You have the loss of belief in objectivity and objective values.
Yes. I think it's a massive factor. In a sense, that is almost a negative factor, isn't it? It's people saying, well, I'm worried about certain trends. I don't find them conclusive. I don't find them sufficiently backed up by evidence. And then turning and looking at an institution which still, thankfully, puts forward a positive which contradicts these things. I mean, there are many people who have seen the Catholic Church in relation to her moral teaching as a sign of contradiction, as opposing secularism, her efforts in the pro-life area, for example, that the impression is given often that although she's attacked scathingly, that she just won't give in. In the final issue, she won't give in. Yes, we know that there are people, even certain theologians, who almost argue that she should give in, but in the final issue, she doesn't. I'm tempted to say that we've had an illustration of that in the last couple of weeks in relation to the Synod on the Family, but maybe I should hesitate.
Yeah, let's talk about more happy things.
Yes.
You had the case of a very well-known English writer of fiction who converted to Catholicism and converted back. John, I'm talking about the writer A.N. Wilson. He, for example, wrote a biography of Hilaire Belloc.
Yes, that's right. Wilson has written an enormous amount of things in this country and is sometimes been criticized for a sort of certain superficiality in his research. But he started off, I think, as an Anglican. He then found Hilaire Belloc, and I think in a sense I did as well, to a certain extent, was very impressed with Belloc, wrote a book on him, presented a documentary on him, but very quickly lost his enthusiasm. I think, I'm trying to think of the order in which he did these things, but he seemed to go straight to a position of really of atheism, and then a sort of wistful agnosticism. Then the next stage was what he referred to as a fideism, which, of course, was spoken of by, I suppose, Pius X, wasn't it, when he condemned the modernists?
Yes.
Just a sort of subjectivism, a sort of wistful subjectivism. And then, relatively recently, he wrote an article in a newspaper in this country, in which he described a return to, well, really the Church of England, where he'd started from. I think a certain worry about moral issues in this country, though, heaven forbid, I don't know that the Anglican Church is going to alter it in its present history. But I remember, funnily enough, you mentioned him, I remember attending a lecture of his. He'd written very recently a book on Dante, and I asked him a little bit about his partial reconversion, but he was very coy indeed about it, and certainly he's not come back to the Catholic Church as such. Sadly, there are more examples of...
You do find multiple examples just kind of in and out?
You do, yes. In my country, Douglas Hyde, who was a staunch communist, and then wrote vigorously against the communists at the end of the Second World War, became a Catholic, and then rather got disillusioned and very much into the liberation theology and started to dislike John Paul II and had reached a sort of agnostic position by the end of his life. Another example, a more famous example, of course, is Graham Greene.
But Greene never left the church, did he?
Well, at the end of his life, he had an association with a Spanish priest, and he was very influential on him. Carried around prayer cards, one particularly of Padre Pio, but in some moods talked about himself as being a Catholic atheist. I don't know. Some people argue that he never really truly converted, that it was for sort of marriage purposes.
Well, I think I'm confident he was a genuine convert. His last novel, I believe, was Monsignor Quixote.
That's right, yes.
In which he has two characters, one a priest, arguing issues of the Divine Trinity and transubstantiation.
Yes, arguing with a communist mayor, I think.
Yes, that's right, in Spain, I believe.
Yeah, and there is more signs there, isn't it, of a sort of Catholicity in his writings. He seemed to get very much involved with sort of, as I say, liberation theology movement in Central America with regard to, say, Nicaragua. I remember Daniel Ortega and this sort of stuff at that time. But yeah, I think you're right in that in these final days, he certainly would have reckoned himself to be a Catholic. Don't think there's any doubts about that.
Are these kind of high-profile conversions still going on in England? But that's a question you'll answer on the other side of our break. Please come back and listen more on my interview with John Beaumont about converts. We'll be back in just a moment.
Journalistic integrity was questioned when I approached the story about 40 Days of Life and did not include what the accuser thought was a balanced view from the other side. The issue was that the other side didn't want to go on the record. See, there's a price to pay for speaking truth. But what is truth? The Bible teaches us that murder is wrong. The unborn is a person. Just read the Gospel of Luke. For behold, when the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby leaped in my womb for joy. And in Jeremiah, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I've appointed you a prophet to the nations. Therefore, we know it is wrong to murder the unborn. Yet, I'm still attacked for standing by the Word of God. So what would Jesus say today when the majority do not agree with me for defending Scripture? He would say, speak truth anyway. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Dunn-Hagarmo, a communication evangelist.
The Ave Maria Communication Skills invites you to activate your faith. All pro-life prayer warriors are invited to join a Eucharistic procession from St. Francis of Assisi Church to Planned Parenthood in Ann Arbor Saturday, November 1st. This prayerful journey is a little over a mile long and part of the 40 Days for Life. For further details, call 734-657-1936. The 6th Annual Ladies Tea Luncheon and Fashion Show will be held Sunday, November 2nd at Sacred Heart Byzantine Church in Livonia. This is a great afternoon to share with your gal pals with the chance of winning fun door prizes and raffles. Tickets are $30 and benefit church maintenance. For further details, call 734-522-3166. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077. Catholic Radio, it's yours to keep and to grow.
I'm back with John Beaumont, who is the author of very comprehensive and interesting books on converts. One about English converts called Road to Rome, a guide to notable converts from Britain and Ireland, from the Reformation to the present day. The other, published this year by Fidelity Press, The Mississippi Flows into the Tiber, a guide to notable American converts to the Catholic Church. John, I was asking you before break whether or not any specific reasons come up as to why people enter the church or leave the religious tradition they're a part of, and you had some more to say about that.
Well, I think really what it was if we talk about God, Christ, and the church, notable number of things that people emphasize when they become Catholics in relation to the Church. I think sort of 9 or 10 specific things. Visibility is one important thing. What you have is a concrete church from the start, and the idea of an invisible church is very much a later development of the Reformation. And I think people are attracted by the visibility, the concrete form of the church. And of course they're also particularly attracted in many cases by its very Catholicity, its universality. Some of them talk about it being real democracy, in other words, the rich and the poor next to each other in church, and all colours, all ages, the notion of a big family. And continuity, the idea of unbroken continuity, that yes, the church develops but remains essentially the same. Question often put to Protestants is, well, before Luther, where was your church? And it's very difficult to answer other than to say, well, it must have been the Catholic Church. And, well, if the teaching of that old church is corrupt, what's happened to the promises of Christ? Very significant issues which are often found compelling by converts. In the sense of continuity, well, I like to refer to it as endurance, really, but endurance not just simple endurance, but endurance in what I call astonishing circumstances, and the astonishing circumstances are the bad things that go on in the church. You know, we only have to look at the last few years with regard to the...
Or the last few weeks. I'm talking to John Beaumont about his book on converts. Now, I also asked you, but I didn't let you answer, whether or not there are still these kind of high-profile conversions going on in England. Are they?
Yes. I think there was a period in the 80s when a significant number of people, a notable number of politicians, strangely enough, who came into the church. And, of course, in relatively recent times, the ex-Prime Minister, Tony Blair, became a Catholic after threatening to do so on...
But that must have caused a lot of waves, did it?
Well, I'm not so sure that it did, because I think it was expected. He was a member of a government that said on a number of occasions when he was Prime Minister that they didn't do religion. And mm-hmm. once he ceased being Prime Minister, he obviously decided that they did do it. Mm-hmm. What I think made waves was that while he'd been in office, he had been very much pro-abortion, never voted against it.
Yeah, and followed his wife on that.
Yeah, and since this was a public reception, and reception of a public figure, normally I think one would have expected some sort of statement with regard to that. He wasn't asked to give one, and he certainly didn't give one. And this, I think, caused some dissension, but that was basically among Catholics, of course, at his becoming a Catholic. The answer is yes, there are a number of literary figures, but not in the same ilk as the days of Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh and people of that kind. Is the general answer. And I think, as I was saying, this continuity issue was... it comes up time and again as a significant factor. And, people tend to think that the bad things in the church discredit the church, whereas many converts actually ended up finding that the bad things in the church proved it. I quoted in the book from the writer Julian Green, who...
By the way, Julian Green was one of the men who brought me into the church.
Right.
His novels.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I had the great privilege of corresponding with him before he died.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. Yeah. Of course, it's a strange situation, isn't it, that he was technically an American but lived in France and wrote in French virtually all his life.
He had a dual citizenship. His mother was from the South.
Right.
And he was the first American to be voted into the Académie Française.
That's right, isn't it? Yes, yeah. There's this wonderful statement by him. In fact, I took the opportunity to look it up beforehand. He says this, and it's wonderful, really. He says, it's not saints that one has to talk about if one is to prove the sanctity of the church. It's bad priests and popes. A church given by saints continues on. That's normal and human. But a church that can be given by villains and imbeciles and still continue, that's neither normal nor human.
That's the miracle.
It is indeed. I love that encounter between Napoleon and Cardinal Consalvi when Napoleon says to the Cardinal, don't you realize that if I wished I could destroy the church? And Consalvi replies, Your Majesty, even we clerics have not managed that in nearly 2,000 years. Wonderful.
By the way, I was looking through your list of some of the people you include in your book on American converts, and there was one name that popped out that I did not know, and that was Buffalo Bill.
Yes.
What's the story behind that?
Well, I don't think we know a great deal about it, quite honestly. We know that he converted. Don't particularly know the exact influences. I mean, in this sort of what might be called the West, we have what, Jim Bowie, Kit Carson, and then we have several Native Americans, Chief Black Elk, I think, mm-hmm. was one. Some people claim Sitting Bull, but I'm not certain that that is mm-hmm. the case. I think it probably is not. Buffalo Bill, I just don't know. I think it was towards the end of his life. Of course, he came to Britain, didn't he? Not that I'm claiming
with his traveling show?
That's right, yes. And even met Queen Victoria, I believe, on one famous occasion. so mm-hmm. it's remarkable, really, the number of people and the strange individuals who make their way there. I found, in a sense, the one of the most significant was, have you heard of Arthur Simon Flegenheimer?
No, you got me. Unless he's off Simons, the writer.
No.
I haven't heard of him.
Right. Well, that's his real name, but he was known by another name, which is Dutch Schultz. He was the mobster who...
Oh, really?
Who ruled in New York. He was born in the Bronx. He died in Newark. Lived for 34 years. And very much involved with crime, very much involved with bringing in liquor from Canada, became very wealthy, number one in the rackets extortion, and killed his rivals, and then eventually gunned down by a hitman, and baptized and given the last rites by a priest at his request, and died later on the same day. And then, of course, was entitled to be buried in a Catholic cemetery. Well, there was outrage at the time, and the papers said, here we are, this dreadful church, which supposes it has the horror of the slightest sin, but beckoning into her fold a man whose whole life should be condemned. Of course, some good priests got writing and answered this point and made various points of their own, that only one person can judge the whole of a life, and there's no crime that can't be forgiven if somebody was truly contrite. So we don't know. We don't know whether he made it, but there's some good good examples, namely the penitent thief is another example. And Dutch was rather lucky in that he had a very good wife who had been praying for him for several years. So in he came. And,
well, a lot of converts, especially some of the more famous ones, came into the church after years of prayer by mothers or by wives.
Yes, indeed, absolutely.
I mean, we don't have to mention St. Augustine because everybody knows that, but in the case of John Wayne is a good example of that.
Indeed, his wife, I think, was urging on Our Lady and the saints, and eventually got her wishes. And there are many others.
Didn't the same thing happen with Bob Hope?
I think almost exactly the same. I think actually he came into the church a little bit before his death. I think Wayne was basically a deathbed convert, but I think Hope was sort of a practicing convert, maybe for a couple of years or so.
Yeah, his wife Dolores was very well known in Catholic circles, particularly in Southern California.
She
was quite a well-known philanthropist. But she had a prayer group that Father Benedict Rochelle would go to every year.
Right, yes. I find it remarkable as to how many in the movie industry converted. I mean, just off the top of my head, well, you've mentioned Hope, You mentioned Wayne. I'll mention Gary Cooper, Louise Brooks, Faye Dunaway.
Now that just completes my total love and devotion for Louise Brooks. Because yes. I did not know she had become a Catholic. You must tell me right now about that.
Yeah, she did indeed. And then there's Dolores Hart, remember, who starred with Elvis and ended up, I think, at the Oscar ceremonies. June Havers, Susan Hayward, Betty Hutton, Virginia Mayo, many women. And then you get certain reverts. Martin Sheen, I think, is a revert, is he not? And then more women, Mary Astor, Jane Wyman, all converts. It's remarkable, really. I mean, I tended to think, well, the biggest number would come from literary circles, but it doesn't. It comes really from the movies and entertainment, strangely.
You know, John, I'm not surprised given that these actors and directors and so forth, they're dealing with a visual medium.
Yes.
And the Catholic Church is very much one that relies on the eyes.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the explanation for converts who were in my British book and could be in a book of French converts, the 19th century decadents, Wilde, Aubrey Beardsley, Ernest Dowson, almost always it's the significance is in the beauty then of the liturgy, the beauty of the churches, architecture, things of this kind make a big impact on such people.
Well, do you recall a little more about Louise Brooks? Because she of course, was one of the most famous actresses of the silent era.
As far as I can recall, and the answer is no, I hope you'll excuse me for not knowing everything about all of these. I think it was fairly late on. I'm just flicking over the pages now to try and find and go.
She ended up on Skid Row in New York City until she was rediscovered by a film historian.
And then she wrote
James,
the book, didn't she?
James Card.
Yeah, that's right. I have her converting. She was born in 1906, and I have her converting in 1953.
Oh.
Living on until 1985. And I think writing a number of... she wrote a book called Lulu in Hollywood, her memoir, and then some other people wrote about her, including, funnily enough, the critic Kenneth Tynan, who wrote a piece in The New Yorker, which probably brought her back into the sort of public arena. Yes, indeed. And somebody writes about her with her famous bobbed black hair, spit curls curving across white cheeks, sultry eyes, and penetrating gaze.
Yeah, well, watch Pandora's Box if you want to see what a great silent film actor
is capable
of doing.
Yeah, I think it's amazing the variety of characters. I mean, I flipped back to her, and I came across, well, I mentioned Jim Bowie, Robert Bork, of course. It's impossible to classify them. I mean, one might say there's quite a number of spies. I can think of three, all of whom were converted by Fulton Sheen, of course, Elizabeth Bentley, Bella Dodd, and Louis Boudens. I think, could be classified as spies,
certainly,
and yet became Catholics through his influence, a major influence, of course.
And then there are the literary figures like Alan Tate, Walker Percy.
They
seem to be Southerners, am I right?
Yes, I think you are. Yeah, is Caroline Gordon, I think, was...
Right, of course. That was the wife of Alan Tate.
The famous ones, well, to me, Walker Percy stands out.
Yes.
You talked about modernity. He's sort of writings on the dislocation of modern man and the limits of science. I think a wonderful, quite honestly, amazing character. There's a couple who came in pretty... Well, one came in pretty late. That's Wallace Stevens, the poet. And some people allege that Tennessee Williams came in for a day when he wasn't feeling too good.
that would figure.
And then left again. I think that might be slightly unfair, but not all that unfair. And I think the most controversial one, in a certain sense, or has been until recently, is Hemingway. because many people, I think, assume that Hemingway was either a nominal or a bogus Catholic, but I think H.R. Stoneback in New York has done an amazing amount of work and written a great deal showing much more of a Catholic in Hemingway and in his life. Okay, there are difficulties, but there are many things which stand out and which I don't think were brought out in the early biographies. So really recommend your listeners to get into Stoneback's books, because they're fascinating.
I didn't know that Hemingway was a practicing Catholic at any point.
Well, I think there were periods when he was, periods when he wasn't. But I think there's an element to him of a more serious...
Oh, he's a serious moral writer. I mean,
yeah.
He writes about men and women in morally charged situations. That's
sure.
What he does.
Okay. Another one who was in what I might call your in-and-out brigade, in fact, more than once, is Robert Lowell, the poet.
Who was a very close friend of Flannery O'Connor's during their days
together in Iowa. Into the church in 41, out in 44, in again in 49, and out in 55. So, not the most consistent of Catholics. What was his link with Flannery O'Connor then?
They were both at the Iowa Writers' Conference at the same time.
And
Robert Lowell was the first man that Flannery O'Connor ever got a crush on.
I see,
a huge
right.
crush on Robert Lowell, who's a very handsome man, by the way.
She is undoubtedly my favorite Catholic writer of all writers. Wonderful.
She's the great. She really is.
Absolutely.
And as a modern writer as you would want.
Indeed, yes, yeah. You talked about science, and you mentioned how people get disillusioned with science. People, of course, get bewitched by it. One shouldn't forget the pretty eminent scientists who, particularly in America, John von Neumann, the mathematician, who, of course, was the model for Dr. Strangelove in Kubrick's
right.
film, and then Sylvanus Morley, the archaeologist, the model for Indiana Jones, I believe. Carl Landsteiner, the biologist, Edward Lee Green, the botanist, and then Gertie Corey, the biochemist, who I think was the first American lady to win a Nobel Prize, certainly in science.
Is it true to say that intellectuals as a group are drawn to the Catholic Church?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm tempted to say they ought to be. Because if one looks historically, there are so many people who I think, once they're over that step of the existence of God and the divinity of Christ, look at the Catholic Church and think, it's surely pretty easy, historically and philosophically, to see that this surely is the one true church. It's the only one that claims to be the one true church. And the idea of a church which is the one true church, not claiming to be, seems to me to be philosophically hard to take. Maybe I'm wrong there, but I think not. So, I think that the age of after the council was not an easy one from many perspectives. I know we're not talking about that this evening, but I think it was much easier for people, say, in the 20s and the 30s, under the influence, say, of Martin Darcy and Monsignor Knox, to find the Catholic Church, because the arguments put forward were pretty solid, really.
And you had the influence on both sides of the ocean of Jacques Maritain, the great Catholic philosopher.
Yeah,
and he had lots of converts in his circles.
And I know from your own, I read your account, An American Conversion. I know you were particularly influenced. Is that not right?
Oh, yes, very much.
Yes, indeed.
There was an in-and-out conversion of under Maritain in France of a rather famous man named Jean Cocteau.
Right, yes, yeah. So you've mentioned, in a sense, yourself, a French influence, Maritain, Julian Green. Are there others that from France that had an influence on you?
Mauriac and Bernanos.
Right, yes. Bernanos in relation to myself, and also Peguy and Claudel as well.
Father Bouillet's book, Spirit and Forms of Protestantism, was tremendous.
Right, yes, yes. Because your background was from the Baptist.
Southern Baptist.
Right, yes.
But the other great writer was Sigrid Undset, who was a convert herself, a Norwegian.
Yes, indeed so. And I don't know whether I'll ever get a third volume done, but I did actually prepare.
Well, you have to do European converts now.
Yeah. Well, I've called it other converts, because there's a country called Australia, remember?
They always get left out. We shouldn't do that.
But Sigrid Undset, of course, is close to my heart, because Father Yaki wrote a very fine book on Undset. He became very interested in her, and spent some time in Norway doing a lot of research, and his book, which I would recommend very, very highly indeed, is wonderful, magnificent, really, in which he goes into great detail about her conversion. And
another Catholic writer who was a Southern writer, another convert, I should say, Andrew Lytle, wrote a book on Sigrid Undset, a book specifically on her Nobel Prize-winning Kristin Lovren's daughter.
Right, yes, yeah, which is magnificent. She was an amazing character. She wrote a number of small pamphlets which didn't become available until Father Yaki did his research, and they now are available with It's Real View Books, who produce his materials. And one of these pamphlets has in the appendix a detailed account that Undset gave. I think it was hidden for many years and didn't come out long after her death. Because, of course, she finished up in the United States for a while, didn't she?
She had to flee Norway after her son got killed by the Russians in the Second World War.
Right,
and, right. And then she went, actually, killed by the Germans, of course. But she went on the Siberian Railroad all the way.
Amazing, yeah,
yes,
didn't she?
And came to the United States in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
John, tell us a little bit about your speaking tour in America, and I know you were very appreciative of the people who brought you here and took care of you.
I'd like to mention that I came to the States in May and June and gave some presentations, basically on the East Coast, essentially in New York and Washington, and it's just a sort of, to be honest, thank you, America. They people were most welcoming. I didn't know, I knew there were Anglophiles, but they all seemed to be Anglophiles and were very affectionate, very welcoming, and I'd just like to express my thanks to all of them for coming along and being inflicted on by me, really. Yeah.
What did your fellow Englishmen think of your book on English converts? Were they put off? Were they welcoming? They feel
sure.
About it?
British and Irish as well. I know that the Scots tried to leave us recently, but they're still there. I think, in a sense, the book is better known in the United States because it's a U.S. publisher. And although there are people acting over here, essentially it was still aimed at the U.S. market, because I think your Catholic market is just, frankly, so much bigger. It's very small in this country, it really is, and it suffered a lot over the last 20 or 30 years. But the general response was surprised that there were so many significant and notable characters. I was rather lucky in that, of course, when I brought the book out, it coincided with the then Pope Benedict XVI coming to this country in order to beatify John Henry Newman. Probably the greatest, almost certainly the greatest of all English converts. So that gave a fillip to the book, obviously, in a way that any other thing would have been hard to come by, really.
John, I want to mention one more time before we sign off about where listeners can find your books. We're talking about two books. One is from St. Augustine's Press. Roads to Rome, A Guide to Notable Converts from Britain and Ireland, from the Reformation to Present Day. And the other one?
I just say a little bit more about the British one. That's published by, as you say, St. Augustine's Press in South Bend. There will be a new edition, and there will also be a supplement to the existing edition very shortly, which will be available on the website of St. Augustine's Press. The other book, the American book, is Fidelity Press. That's available from fidelity.org.
And I hope that our listeners will find your books and enjoy them. It's going to be a great pleasure for me to get into them.
Right.
John Beaumont, thank you for being a guest on Church and Culture.
And many thanks, Steel. I've enjoyed it thoroughly. And thank you to your listeners as well for listening in.
And to all of you who have been listening, please join me again this time on this day for several more interesting guests on Church and Culture.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. For our program this week, we have a very special talk we just recorded. Our speaker is Boston College Professor of Philosophy Peter Kraft. With a pro-euthanasia and pro-abortion presidential candidate and a pro-abortion governor who is backing a state proposal that allows for the virtual unrestricted killing of embryos for their stem cells, Christians have to be informed. We have to unmask the purposely clouded issues being put forth through a $20 million plus advertising campaign. We have to know the truth, and we have to vote according to our faith. Dr. Peter Kraft is a very informed and eloquent teacher who is also a convert to the faith. He'll be addressing the topic of voting as an informed Catholic. This is not a program to be missed. So you're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Won't you join us for a talk by one of the foremost Christian teachers in the world today, Dr. Peter Kraft, teaching on voting as a Catholic? Dr. Kraft will be introduced by Father John Ricardo. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting on the Mind of Christ on Ave Maria Radio.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
By baptism, we all share the priesthood of Christ, and that gives us the responsibility to do and live as he did. Actions speak louder than words, much louder. Because we're loved by God, we have a responsibility to share that love with others. Which others? The children of God. They're our family members, classmates, fellow workers, the person sitting opposite, the woman on the street asking for food and shelter, the child in Somalia without food or drink, the friend who's being taunted in the corridor, and the jerk who's taunting him. We all share the same relationship to God, and that makes us brother and sister. If we call ourselves brothers and sisters in Christ, then our lives must reflect it. Let us burden no one and be a people who reflect the love and encouragement of God to others. As I remember this, I remembered an old song. They'll know we are Christians by our love. And it's true, not by our work, not by our job or qualifications, but because we open our arms to welcome the needy. They will know we are Christians because of our kindness. They'll know we're Christians by our encouraging words. They'll know we're Christians when we stand with the homeless on the streets to be their